William is going to read first, and he is the author of over 45 short stories, 60 articles, and 350 reviews. He's a distinguished professor, actually a professor emeritus. Is that how you say it? Emeritus? I don't know how to say it. Emeritus? Good. Okay. I know. It sounds more interesting, doesn't it? Okay. At the University of Missouri Columbia, and he's been the recipient of the Guggenheim, Fulbright, and DuPont Junior and Senior Fellowships. He is the past editor of Story and was a fiction judge for the 1961 National Book Awards. He is also the editor of the Missouri Review. And he has just finished a collection of 30 stories that he's calling The Confident Lovers. Okay. Anyway, and I'd like to welcome William Peden.
Thank you very much, and thank you all. What I plan to do tonight is to read and comment briefly on a kind of short story that I have found. Can you all hear me? That I have found increasingly congenial in the last 5 or 10 years, which I call skinny fictions or mini fictions. These are small narratives, but they are not the traditional short stories, which tend to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. They are not these at all. They are brief narrative sketches. And I would like to say just a little bit in introduction about each one as I read them. And just so you're not going to expect more than I am able to give you, these are completely unplotted. They depend, I think, for their effect, if they have any effect, is a kind of character revelation. And yet, immediately having said that, I want to retract it because they are not intellectual stories. They are simply skinny fictions. Now, the first of these, and it is the first that I wrote, basically I have worked over the years in a much more conventional and traditional narrative mode. The first of these is entitled Boone County Parable. I live in Boone County, Missouri, and this comes very close to being nonfiction. It is almost an actual account of something which I witnessed. Actually, it's extremely, although I was not aware of it at the time, somebody pointed it out to me angrily some years ago, it's utterly Marxist in its philosophy. There is a good guy who is a member of the working class and a bad woman who is a member of the leisured upper middle class. That's all I want to say about it. Let it stand or fall on its own. For reasons which I do not understand but which delighted me, it was recently anthologized. It was published first in a little book edited by two students of mine and was a year or two ago reprinted in what I'm told is the most widely read textbook in American universities and colleges in the field of the short story, the Norton Book of Stories, edited by Verlin Castle, who's a friend of mine, which I guess is the main reason why this story was included in that very influential book, Boone County Parable. We rode our bikes to the shopping center that afternoon. Usually in mid-July, it's too hot in Little Dixie to ride, but this was like October in the Shenandoah Valley. Miss Peaches wanted to buy some dress material, and I waited outside the fabric shop with our bikes. 4:30, the shopping center was almost empty. Then a man approached me, a countryman, about 30, with a curiously blank, unlined, pleasant face. He had very dark hair, and he wore a clean t-shirt and stained tan work pants, and he was unbelievably cross-eyed. As he came near me, I stepped back from the edge of the sidewalk. Our faces met. I nodded. "Hi," I said. He hesitated. "Hello," he said. "Beautiful afternoon," I said. "Beautiful." He stopped and looked at me. That is, his crossed eyes revolved towards me, and he smiled a very tentative smile. When I smiled back, he extended his hand. "Yes," he said, "beautiful." We shook hands. "I went fishing last night," he said abruptly. His voice was flat, pleasant, a slight drawl, slightly nasal, a good Little Dixie voice. "Did you?" I asked. "Any luck?" He smiled, no longer tentatively, and again his crossed eyes revolved towards me. "Caught two flatheads," he said, "big ones." "Good," I said. "Whereabouts?" "On Perchy Creek." He half closed his eyes, ran his hands through his hair. "Got caught, too." "Caught?" I asked. "What do you mean, caught? Didn't you have a fishing license?" He pointed towards his hip pocket. "Game warden caught me, but I had my license all the time, in my wallet." "Ah, good," I said. Beyond the drive-in theater, we heard the whinny of a horse, a high, imperious laughing. The man shook his head slowly before confronting me with his crossed eyes. "That's not all," he said. "There was an accident at the creek." "Oh?" I asked. "I hadn't heard. I haven't seen the paper today." "From the bridge," he said. "Someone fell on the rocks from the bridge." "From the bridge? Is that right?" "My daughter," he said. "It was my daughter that fell from the bridge." "Good Lord," I said. I hope. He interrupted me. The crossed eyes circled around and beyond me. The strangely sweet, empty face was unchanged. "She didn't last very long," he said. "I'm sorry," I stammered. But he raised his hand, palm up, the stained fingers outspread. "She didn't last hardly at all." "I'm sorry," I said again. Thanks, he said, friendship and recognition in his voice and unlined face. His voice was hardly audible, and then he turned, and I watched him until he disappeared into the dime store. Miss Peaches came out with the material a few minutes later, and I fastened the package in the clamp over my rear mudguard. "There'll be a lot of traffic from the MFA," I said. "Be careful." We rode our bikes across the almost empty parking lot, down the winding road alongside the drive-in, and past the fairgrounds and the show ring, where a couple of pre-teenagers were trotting their ponies. A steady stream of cars from the MFA insurance office inched down Ash Street, and I eased very carefully onto the road, looked back at Miss Peaches, keeping as close to the curb as possible. A pale green Cadillac crept up behind me, then alongside me, crowding me. I looked at the driver behind the tightly closed windows, pale, red-headed 30-ish doughface, and I gestured towards her to move over, to give me room, but she kept crowding me till my ankle scraped painfully against the curb. My bike wobbled for a moment, then my foot was on the curb, the bike was steady, and the red-headed woman in the Cadillac moved on. "Are you all right?" Miss Peaches was calling behind me. "Are you all right?" "Yes," I said, "I'm all right." I pointed towards the receding pale green car. I could scarcely see the woman's red head above the steering wheel. "Goddamn mother," I said. "Goddamn lowborn mother." That's all on that one. Now, that, as I say, that was a ready-made story. It doesn't often happen. It doesn't often happen that way. And it's that's literally true. The child had drowned. The man was buying stuff in the dime store. And the mother in the green car almost killed me. Now, this next one is called The Hatchet Man in the Lighthouse. This is to a degree based on an incident that happened, but it is purely fiction. That is a kind of combination. That is almost nonfiction, that first one. The Hatchet Man in the Lighthouse. I had the pleasure of reading this to a group of graduate students at the University of the Americas in Puebla, Mexico, about a month ago. And there's a slight element of fantasy in it that I think reverberates in Latin Americans, maybe with a little more vigor than it does in us North Americans. At any rate, I was delighted that they seemed to like it, and I hope maybe you will, too. The Hatchet Man in the Lighthouse. We were sitting on the trunk of a fallen palmetto pine, Miss Peaches and I, waiting for the sun to set. Far down the beach, where curving strand and sky merge, we can glimpse the pale blue-pink smudge that is Savannah. Below us, a few vacationers still linger on the sand, but to the east, the shore is deserted. It is almost time to go home for dinner. The moon has not yet risen. The tide is coming in. Out of nowhere, a boy jogs towards us. He is neither city pale nor tidewater tan. He looks to be between 6 and 7 years old. A few yards from us, he slows down, hesitates, finally stops in front of Miss Peaches. "Hi," she says and smiles. So do I. Hello, he replies somewhat formally. A city boy from Savannah, perhaps, maybe Beaufort. He's a fine-looking youngster, well-formed, and with clear blue eyes. Been swimming, I ask, a foolish question. His hair is wet, soaking wet. How was the water? Yes, he says, and scratches in the sand with his toes. It was good. Miss Peaches nods agreement. We've been in twice today. The surf was wonderful, just right. The boy starts to say something, hesitates, and points across the shining sea toward the mainland. I've been there, too, he announces. Have you? We nod. The boy squints and points again. Do you see it? See what? I ask, squinting in turn. The lighthouse. His voice is mildly patronizing. Way down there, the lighthouse. There's no lighthouse there, I start to say, but Miss Peaches interrupts. Yes, she tells the boy, we see it. Have you ever been there? No, I say, no, we've never been there. I have. His voice is firm, it brooks no disagreement. My mom and dad took me there. Did they? Miss Peaches asks. What fun that must have been. What's the lighthouse like? He hesitates. It's big, he says after a pause. It's very big. Is it? I say. How big? He looks through me and beyond me, eyes narrowed, scanning the horizon. It's big enough for him. For him? Miss Peaches and I speak in unison, as though the scene had been rehearsed. The hatchet man. His voice is very serious, very earnest. A giant hatchet man. The hatchet man, I say? I never knew. I mean, what's he like, this hatchet man? The boy's clear blue eyes travel from mine. He is seeing something I cannot see. He's huge. He gestures with both hands. He's gargantuan. Is he? I suppress a smile, shake my head, and glance towards Miss Peaches. The boy nods emphatically. There are seahorses out there, too. He extends his arms, embracing the entire expanse of land and slowly darkening sea. Man-sized seahorses. Yes, Miss Peaches says hastily, we've seen them, but we've never seen the hatchet man. What does he do there? What's he like? Again, the boy scratches the sand with his toes. He's very ugly, he says, after a long, thoughtful pause. He's as ugly as sin. He hesitates while I bite my lip to suppress a smile. But he's very, very kind. Kind, I say? That's good to know. I'm glad to know that he's kind. But why do you call him the hatchet man? He looks at me with diminishing patience. Because that's who he is. Everybody. He slowly shakes his head as if in disbelief. Almost everybody knows that. Toward Savannah, the blue-pink smudge has turned the color of smoke, but in the east a faint glimmer illuminates the water. Soon the moon will be rising. There is a slight offshore breeze, but there may be some mosquitoes. It is time for us to go back to the house. I extend my hand towards the boy. It's very interesting, all these things. Perhaps we'll see you again tomorrow, and you can tell us more about him. We'd like to hear more about the Hatchet Man and the seahorses, too. He shakes my hand. He no longer seems irritated at my stupidity. I'll come back, he says. I'll come back tomorrow morning. Be sure to, Miss Peaches says. We want to hear more about him. She leans over and runs her hand lightly through his damp hair. He smiles, heads toward the hard-packed sand at the edge of the sea, and turns and waves to us. We wave back. My mom, he calls, his voice clear and distinct. My mom's dead. We say nothing as he turns off and jogs away. Well coordinated, light on his feet, he will become a good middle distance runner. Miss Peaches and I watch him without speaking until he is only a speck in the distance. I think he stops once to wave, but at that distance and without my glasses, I cannot be sure.
Thank you.
Now this next one, I hope it won't offend anybody. It's entitled The Polar Bear in the Ozarks. Now this happened as the genesis of this was a dream. Actually, the dream took place in Virginia, a place about midway between Charlottesville and Lexington, where I lived for a great many years, and I know the particular scene as well as I know my own hand. And all there was in the dream, in this place with which I was so very familiar, was a polar bear lying on his back in the road. And he did something. I changed it to The Polar Bear in the Ozarks after it was first published. And a friend of mine who was editing a book on the Ozarks wanted to use it in his book. I was very happy, but at the last minute I withdrew it because it seemed very pretentious of me, since my knowledge of the Ozarks is limited to driving a few times from Columbia to Fayetteville with one stop off in West Plains, which is Petch's hometown. But this is really The Polar Bear in the Blue Ridge, but I changed it to The Polar Bear in the Ozarks. And as I say, I hope it won't offend anybody. A warm afternoon in mid-October. We were on our way, Miss Peaches and I, to West Plains. After a warm summer and a cold snap early in October, southern Missouri was at its best. Trees, a riot of color, air as sparkling as wine, to coin a couple of phrases. Very few cars on the road. Earlier, we had stopped at a small country hotel for one of the best broiled trout we had had in years. They didn't serve wine, but we had a jug of Chablis in the car, and we'd drunk a lot of it with the owner of the hotel. And now I wanted to stretch my legs, walk around a bit, and relieve my bladder. We'd left Springfield early that morning, but had stopped frequently. We were in no hurry. We were feeling good. The sun was warm for a late afternoon in autumn, so we drank what was left of the wine, feeling very good, slightly high. Back in the road, driving slowly along a winding, slightly ascending drive, 40 or so miles from West Plains. Suddenly, My heart lurches. I slam on the brakes. We come to a squealing stop, inches away from a body lying in the middle of the road. A gigantic polar bear is lying awkwardly in front of us. Parenthetically, I should admit that I have a very good feeling about polar bears. They played a very important part in my life a few years ago. As a matter of fact, a polar bear once almost saved my life. I never, never miss the opportunity to visit the polar bear pits whenever I am near a zoo. Polar bears are full of grace and dignity, and I believe, compassion. I have spent hours sitting in front of the pits at the St. Louis Zoo, the best polar bear pits in the United States. Rocky slopes, ledges for sunbathing, a pool into which they dive with unbelievable grace, agility, and beauty. The poetry of motion. All that enormous strength completely controlled. Beautiful. Should I come back in the form of an animal, I often pray, yes, pray to God Almighty, that it will be in the form of a polar bear, full of grace, dignity, and I feel certain, kindness. But this polar bear does not appear to be full of grace. Almost tragic, his position, lying there on his back, not enjoying the sun as I have seen them do so many times, but almost as though he is in pain. Cautiously, I switch off the ignition. Be careful, Miss Peaches is saying, and then, simultaneously, we draw in our breath in amazement. The polar bear is wearing shoes. Yes, on his hind paws. The front paws are unshod. Gingerly, I get out of the car. The bear raises a massive black-nailed paw. Slowly and seemingly painfully, he swings his beautiful head towards me. Aghast, I am frozen in my tracks. The bear is wearing my shoes. On the left hind paw, a desert boot I had bought in Emporia, Kansas, some years ago when I had gone to the college to give a lecture. On the right hind paw, a wallaby, darker than the desert boot and slightly larger too. I bought the wallabies in London last summer. They had always been a little too large for me, whereas the desert boots had always been not quite large enough, so I always wore thin socks with the desert boots and heavy socks with the wallabies. The bear's shoes are unmistakably mine. I approach the animal gingerly. Be careful, Miss Peaches says again. Please to stay behind, I say. I'll be very careful. Please get into the car and lock the door and roll up the windows. I continue my approach, very cautious, searching for the bear's eyes, on the alert for any sudden movement, but my caution and apprehension are fading. By the time I am within a few feet of him, all my fear vanishes. His beautiful eyes meet mine. They do not waver or turn away like the eyes of all other beasts when confronted by a two-legged animal's gaze. I am within a few feet of him. Less than that, I should say, about a foot would be more accurate when it happens. His eyes are not only kind, but full of recognition, real recognition. I kneel down by the poor shod feet, unlace the shoes, and oh so carefully and gently remove them. Suddenly, To my surprise and discomfort, something happens. A great golden stream arches towards me. I am dampened. I step back quickly, of course, but it was not quickly enough. With great agility, no longer awkward and in pain, the bear rises to his feet and without a backward glance lopes. How beautifully that bear could lope down the road around the bend. Back in the car, shaking my head, we drive off. What do you make of all that? Miss Peaches asks after a short silence. I do not know, I say. I have no idea. Best not to think too much about it, I guess. I believe I have 10 minutes more, so I would like to end by coming back to more normal reality than the reality of that bear. And this may seem sentimental. I reread it a couple of days ago before coming up here, and it did seem to me more sentimental than when I read it. It is complete fiction except for one thing, a reference to the fact that the world was coming to an end. When I was a boy, a group of maniacs who sold and gave away all their belongings because the world was coming to an end. And at the age of 7 or 8, as a very religious child, I wish I could say the same for me now, I was quite upset by the whole business. And later, many years later, I wrote a story entitled Family Portrait, which I will read now and finish with and not exceed my 40 minutes. My father died of a stroke at the age of 60, weeding in his flower garden. I found him lying there a few minutes after breakfast, a small spading fork and a trowel by his side. The peat moss in the trowel was still cool and moist. His blue eyes were open, and I think he recognized me, but he could neither speak nor move. I took off my jacket and placed it carefully over his shoulders. "I'll be right back, Dad. Don't worry. Don't try to move." I run to the house. It is Wednesday. My mother and the maid left shortly after breakfast to do the week's grocery shopping. I call our family doctor and hurry back to the garden. My father lies dead among the dahlias he never got to show at the county fair. He had not been a great success. Worked in the local bank most of his life. After a quarter of a century, he became vice president, but that is as far as he ever went. My mother wanted him to be president of the bank and mayor of the town. A quiet, gentle man whom I never really knew. Had few close friends, neither drank nor smoked. From a family of small farmers, landowners, my mother said, shopkeepers, businessmen, my mother said, school teachers, an occasional doctor or lawyer, ministers, and religious maniacs. Seldom, if ever, cursed. Only once do I remember hearing my father curse. It was after dinner one summer night. I was 8 or 9. My father had been puttering around in the cellar where he had a workshop of some sort, with gardening his only hobby. My mother had been pestering him to do some kind of chore in the kitchen, repairing a leak in the icebox or fixing a light or something. Kept calling him to come up from the cellar, which he finally did, grudgingly. rummaged around beneath the sink where he'd left a heavy wrench or something, straightened up too soon, banged his head terribly, knocked off his glasses, crushed them with his feet or with the wrench. I could hear the lenses tinkling. He was terribly nearsighted. "Damn," he said, not loud, but deep, on his hands and knees, fumbling amongst the broken lenses, rubbing his bruised head. "Damn, God Almighty, Jesus Christ. Walter, how could you?" Mother's back, straight as an arrow, transfixed him with a glance. "Damn," he said again, trying to straighten out the bent frames. For a terrible minute, I thought he was going to cry. Never in my entire life, not once, did I ever see my father cry. God Almighty, Jesus Christ, God damn. Mother went to her room, closed the door, stayed there for a week. I never heard him curse again, not ever. I never knew my father well. He gave me more than I ever gave him. He made things grow. A few weeks before my 10th birthday, I was haunted. Maniacs in the next county had predicted that the world was coming to an end, precisely at midnight, at a specified date in late September, sold all their belongings, and took refuge on a nearby hill. Hardly a hill, this was Tidewater country. Waiting to be saved, all others would be damned. I was terrified. Fear and dread, my constant companions. Dared not speak about it to anybody. Tried several times, but couldn't do it. I joined the Episcopal Church. My father was an ordained deacon before my birthday. Tried to discuss the matter with the minister. Could not. That last night before the end of the world was awful. I lay in bed, staring at the ceiling, waiting for the heavens to open. Finally tiptoed down the long, dark hall to my parents' bedroom. The door was ajar, but I knocked as I'd been taught to. My father and mother were sitting by the open windows. It was hot for late September, and they had turned off the lights against the mosquitoes. From the bedside, the lemony odor of a citronella candle, patches of fog, and from the bay, the recurring blat of a foghorn. "Yes," my mother said, without turning from the window. Courage, resolve left me. I mumbled something and retreated to my room. A few minutes later, I heard my father's knock at the door. He didn't speak. Just pulled a chair close to my bed, put his hand on my back. "You're feverish, son," he said. Sat there beside me in silence, put his hand on mine. Said nothing, just sat there in the darkness, his hand resting lightly on my own, listening to the sound of the foghorn and looking out into the dark yard and the tall wild cherry trees beyond the kitchen garden. A dam in me broke. Is the world really going to come to an end tonight? No, he said finally. The world's not going to come to an end tonight. Patted my hand. The world's always coming to an end. For somebody. But not for us. Not tonight. Not for us. He ran his hand through my hair. You need a haircut, son. We'll go to the barber's tomorrow morning. Squeezed my hand, started to say something else, tiptoed away. A taciturn man, not given to demonstration. Thanks very much.